Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for another Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. And please remember, follow and subscribe, rate and review. My guest today is Detroit area singer-songwriter Nick Puente of Nick Puente and the Complicated Men. Their new album is out on Gem Records and called Heart Inside Your Head. It features our recent coolest song in the world, My Mind's Playing Tricks on Me. We'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my chat with Nick on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Mighty Manfred here with you once more as we get our coolest conversations underway. And my guest today, Detroit area singer-songwriter Nick Puente of Nick Puente and the Complicated Men. How are you, Nick?
Great, Manfred. Thanks for having me once again. I appreciate it. I even gave up a game of golf today to talk to you.
Oh, a game of golf you gave up. I appreciate that. I know we're not talking about putt-putt here. You know, that's my forte. Putt-putt's a different thing, different game, different game. But how many holes would you typically be working on a game?
Oh, you know, 18 holes, you know, nine sometimes. But if I can squeeze 18 holes in, yeah, that's what I do.
Wow. When did you start playing golf?
A little kid. My parents, my dad got me a set of clubs, I think, when I was 7 years old. And you know, my parents were divorced, which was very rare at that time. So that was a way for my dad and I to kind of bond through golf, and he's 89 and he still plays golf as often as his body lets him, and so it's been pretty cool. We bond better with golf than with music. He doesn't quite get it, but he knows that I'm pretty good at it, so.
Well, speaking of your dad, and that makes me think about your family in general. We spoke last August. At the time, it seems like you and your family have been able to remain healthy up to that point over the course of the pandemic. How have things been since then?
Yeah, since then, at the time we were, you know, vaccinated. And, you know, really, I think the thought at the time was if you were vaccinated, get double vaccinated, you pretty much wouldn't get COVID. And then in the winter, everybody was getting it. And I got it, gave it to my wife and daughter. Luckily, didn't give it to my dad. I was at the restaurant one day and I started coughing. He said, "You okay?" I said, "Yeah, I'm fine. I just a cough, you know." And then sure enough, later that day, I tested positive. My wife tried to stay away from me, which is hard for her, you know, but yeah. Anyway, then she got it a couple of days ago, my daughter, but the symptoms weren't too bad. Luckily, my dad didn't get it. But he did get it the following month in January. And again, luckily for him, he was vaccinated and boosted, and symptoms weren't too bad. So we've survived that. Hopefully, you know, we won't get it again. But, you know, as we're all learning about this, it's, you know, we thought we'd be in the clear. That's why the band, when the band was making the record, after a while, we got comfortable being in the room together because we were all vaccinated and didn't think it was going to happen. And then, you know, it did.
We know we've been, I guess we talked, it's been a while since we talked about your rock and roll origins, and I'd like to take a moment to revisit those. Did you really get a guitar for Christmas when you were a kid?
Oh yeah. I still own it. It's a Gibson SG. I had a couple of guitars before then, but that was the first good guitar I got because our band was formed, and I had a Epiphone, made in Japan Epiphone, not a good one of the ones that were made in Kalamazoo. And the action was, I don't know, probably a half an inch off. You know, it's pretty hard to play. And I said, I really need a good guitar, Mom and Dad. So they got me a Gibson SG. And that's the one guitar I kept through all the years. I always buy and trade and sell. Yeah. But that guitar's got sentimental meaning to me. So I'll never let that one go.
Okay, so that wasn't your first guitar. Why did you even start playing guitar?
You know, I had a best friend. His name was Pete Medary. We grew up together, and we were, whenever we met at a bus stop, and he was, I think he was teasing me about, oh yeah, I remember like it was yesterday, because I was really short. I'm still short, but I was really short as a kid. And we were in the line for the bus, and I said, hey, you took cuts in front of me. And he said, oh, you're so short, I didn't even see you. So I popped him, you know, in the face, because I was a scrappy little guy. And he said it really hurt, but he didn't want to make a big scene, and he didn't want to beat me up because he was a new kid in town. But soon after that, we got to be really good friends. And I think I went over to his house to kind of apologize for being a little turd. And we started talking about girls that we were in fourth grade at the time, third grade. We started talking about our interest in girls, and really most boys at that age didn't really like girls, but we did. And then we also talked about music. We both liked music, and he had an older brother that had a 1965 Strat that he could sneak in and play sometimes. And we started actually playing in a talent show. I think we were fourth grade. We learned a couple chords. And in sixth grade, our band, our first band, did our first gig. So that was 1972. It just passed the 50th anniversary of that. And that band was called Sunset. And later, we changed our name to Dwarf a few months later when we had a manager, which was funny. A 12-year-old kids having a manager.
And you chose Dwarf. You chose Dwarf not because of any physical stature, but it has like a Bob Dylan tie-in, right?
Publishing. Dwarf Music was a publishing company. And I was at first, you know, offended by the fact that we were called Dwarf because I was always a little kid in school. And I don't know if we talked about this before, but one of the first shows we played, it was a big benefit concert. Headlining was a band named Julia, who was Bob Seger's backing band, touring band in like 1972. Uh-huh. But they're a really cool pop, very kind of Badfinger-ish, I would think. Great singers, great players. But when the curtains opened, we were the opening act, and the first person they saw was, I think, me. And they said, oh my God, they really are dwarfs, because a little kid, they didn't know I was 12 and 4'2". But yeah, that was the name of the band. And Mike Finn was the other, was a guitar player in that band. And we're still friends. Both Mike and Pete live in California now, but we talk. And so, yeah, that was my origin. That was Mike. And we did have a manager. He was a little bit older guy. It was kind of funny. He was kind of looking for something to do. He just had a bad, he had a bad acid trip. And he's like, okay, I got to find some purpose in my life. So it's crazy. But because he had that experience, he kind of warned us about the perils of drugs. So at 12, it's like, I knew I was never going to do acid after hearing what he did. But his name was Merle, and he was just a huge Beatle music fan, had this amazing record collection, and introduced us to music that we didn't know. And then the music that he really loved, like, for example, the Raspberries. I mean, he was a huge Raspberry fan. He got us into Raspberries, and later the Shoes from Illinois. And then, you know, the Move, so much music, because he was he graduated in 69. We were graduating in 78. So we really got a great education from him.
Yeah, so he must have seemed ancient.
He did. And the fact that our parents would let some, you know, 21-year-old guy come and pick up their 12-year-old kids, and it wouldn't happen today, I don't think, you know.
No.
What are you, where are you going? What is this? Who is this guy? But our parents were they cared. I was gonna say either they didn't care, but they did. But
yeah. Well, in fact, I want to ask you about the family here and being supportive and stuff, because you mentioned your dad not really kind of getting the music thing. I mean, you spent a lot of your early adulthood, young adulthood, pursuing music. I mean, you're still involved with with a family business since you moved back to the Detroit area. What is it? The Italian Steakhouse.
Sibley Gardens, right? Sibley Gardens, correct.
So, but it seems like your family was pretty supportive of right.
Yeah, for sure. When I say my dad doesn't get it, I mean, he gets it, but I mean, he went to a lot of our shows. He was actually in the studio when we were working with George Clinton in Detroit. At the time, they were trying to do start a label called Uncle Jam Records, and we were one of the rock bands that they were recording. So I remember my dad and his wife, Pam, they were at the studio when we were recording. That was 1980, 81. And I think they ignored a lot of the drugs that were going on in the studio at the time. But it was some pretty crazy, you know, Bootsy Collins walking in into the session. It was pretty cool.
Wow. Sounds like just a cool experience in general. Like with Bootsy Collins striding into the session, that must have been pretty wild.
And it was really wild because he was wearing a Confederate Army uniform. I mean, think about that, you know, that's how, what a different time that was. And yeah, he was quite of an imposing figure, but it was like, oh my God, that's Bootsy. It's such a rock star to come to the recording session dressed like that. I mean, that was, you know, he was always on, obviously. Gary Scheider was producing our sessions then. He had the Brides of Funkenstein singing on one of the ballads that we did. It was, it was pretty crazy, but that label never happened. And too much cocaine, I'm sure, got in the way. But
well, so you were doing this, pursuing music for quite a while, and then, and you, the family's being supportive and stuff, but then you decided to stop. And my understanding is, you know, you decided to focus on raising your family. When exactly was that you decided, hey, this, you know, I pursued this and now I need to do something else? About how old were you then?
You know, I think by the time I finally said I got to take a break on this, I was 32 maybe.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like I did so much. I was in a, you know, band since with a, you know, school
high school.
Age. Yeah. Then we played high school and then we played college gigs. Then we moved to California and we kind of did. It's kind of, I think, you know, moving to California was a way of, it's like, let's just see where this is going to happen. And I think it was just obvious that we weren't quite there. We were pretty darn good, but we just, you know, if a band never got a break, it seemed like that was us. It was just, we had some record label interest, but then not quite enough. You know, maybe we weren't enough of a thing. We didn't sound enough like whatever was the, you know, the flavor of the week. So we always just kind of did our own thing, and not too much different than the music I'm still making now. But, you know, I think it was just kind of time. You give up a lot, you know, chasing a dream. And I didn't want everything else to fall by the wayside. I think personal relationships, I only got so close because I'm thinking, what I really wanted was something else. And I met Kelly, my wife, and I remember a friend of mine, her mother, I was just talking to her about like when you meet the right one. And she said, when you meet the right one, you'll know it because you'll want to have kids with her. And I was like, yeah, I got that feeling with Kelly. And and so that's what happened. But I didn't really write songs for a few years. And it wasn't until our first daughter, Marissa, was born that I actually kind of picked up a guitar again, started playing. I said, these songs are pretty good. And then when a few years later, I decided to kind of get back into it. I think I was 40. And that was the time I said, if I don't get back doing music now, when am I going to do it? Mm-hmm. And it was just going to be a hobby. And I really thought at the time I was just going to write songs and maybe I can find somebody to cover some songs. But, it was like, well, maybe I'll just sing them. And that kind of got me interested in it again. And I could balance it, with work and with family. And I didn't play live too much. So it wasn't that many late nights. If I was working in the restaurant, I'd go to the studio in the daytime. And I just kind of wanted to make sure these songs were recorded, saved, maybe show my kids, what I was used to doing, but before they came along. But they proved to be an inspiration in a lot of ways in songwriting. And my daughter, Megan, actually designed a lot of the album covers for us. Right. And the new one, we kind of stole the Operation theme.
I was going to ask you about that in a bit. Something I didn't realize until I was prepping for our chat today was back around, 2010, 2011, a couple of your songs wound up on a TV show, this movie, Jeff Who Lives at Home, and the TV show Mercy. How did you land those? Do you recall?
There was a guy named Greg Leonard that used to be a partners with Jeff Michael at the studio there in Ann Arbor, and he moved to LA. And Jeff said, Greg's got some connections with someone that was, looking for some songs. And those songs were actually songs that recorded with the band The Respectables. That album came out in 2008. And it was power pop, but also a little bit more heavier Detroit rock at the time. It was pretty cool. I mean, it was the first sizable checks I ever got from making music. And it was cool because the band at the time, we all, shared in creating the songs together. It was more of a recording project at the time, but the guitarist, Joe Gatiss, we would just demo the stuff at his house. And Don Denniston, our drummer, who very sadly, he passed away this winter. And that age, I've had too many friends in the last, this last year, that died suddenly, of heart attacks, friends and acquaintances. And it's like five people I know. And it's like, is it COVID related somehow? Is it just the age, the coincidence? But Don was a great drummer. He loved pop music, and that was really sad. But they enjoyed that. They got a kick out of being in a movie. They never had their songs in a movie or anything. All the bands that they've been in. So that was that was a validation. It's like, okay, I'm going to keep doing this, and that band ended, but 2013 released the album 13 in My Head, which kind of explained, where my head was, the fact that I was still playing in a rock band and still had my guitar that I got when I was 13. So part of me remains that, that age.
Well, one of your singles from last year, Hard Inside Your Head, that serves as the title track to the new album. It's out now on Gem Records. There's another 9 cuts on there, including this week's coolest song of the world, My Mind Plays Tricks on Me. Did you record all the songs together, or were things sort of parsed out over the last couple of COVID years?
No, they were all, actually the basic band tracks were done within a couple of weeks of each other earlier, March of 2021. And Heart Inside Your Head and One of the Boys were the first two that were completed.
Yeah.
And I said, let's kind of send these to little Steve and see if he's interested in maybe making one of them the coolest song, just because, you know, usually it's a couple of years in between making records. And
yeah,
by the, I knew by the time the record was done, I said, maybe we can just kind of get our, keep our name out there, keep it fresh. And luckily he chose Heart Inside Your Head. And also one of the boys got quite a bit of airplay too.
Yes. Yeah.
Which it was like, I like them both. And it's like, you never know which, like with Stephen, what he, what's going to strike his fancy, what's he's going to pick.
That's right.
Sometimes it's like, oh, wow, I thought this song was great. He didn't pick it, but it's fantastic to, you know.
To get one picked, I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, it's really hard. I mean, was it 52 of them a year, if that many? So, right. As you know, it's really difficult. And I'd imagine there's probably a lot of music he likes that don't make the cut. So we're really lucky, really fortunate. And so... Hopefully let's talk some, we'll continue.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a moment again about your producer, Jeff Michael. I know he produced the title cut. Did he work on all the recordings with you?
Yeah, he did. He definitely produced all the songs. And then him and I spent a lot of time, you know, working over dubs and getting things ready for mixing. Usually he does the final mixes by himself, and then I'll kind of come in and just say, yeah, this is great. How about adding this or that? But yeah, Jeff Michael, it's pretty much, he's a one-man show. He does the engineering.
Okay.
Produces, he does everything but mastering it. And he could master it, but at that point, it's like, give it to someone else. So Jim Kissling, another Detroit guy, does the mastering for us.
And how do you know Jeff?
I met Jeff when we were actually doing that Respectables album, which was titled Sibley Gardens, oddly enough.
Just coincidental.
Yeah. Actually, our guitarist, Joe, at the time said, why don't we call it Sibley Gardens? This is where we come in and we eat. And it's kind of cool. And he was thinking like Fountains of Wayne, just a business. So right. Instead of naming the band Sibley Gardens, and then cross marketing, you know. But we went in there to do some overdubs because we had a keyboard player play a couple tracks. And then when Jeff just did a rough mix, it was like all of a sudden the song sounded really good. Were sounding like a record, and it's like, man, if he's that good and setting up a mix in a half an hour, maybe he should mix a record, which he did. And then it started a long relationship with him, and been so happy that I really haven't felt need to record with anyone else.
Jeff Hopp on bass, Ron Vensko on the drums, Kevin Darnell on the keyboards. Those are the Complicated Men backing you, right?
Yeah, and then the new Complicated Men is Joe Daxowitz.
Okay.
It might be harder
he's
to
second guitarist
than Punty. Yeah, he's a second guitarist, and he played lead on some tracks too. He came in towards the end of the sessions. I was doing all the guitar parts, but he joined the band, and I thought it would be kind of cool to include him on the album too. So I think four to five tracks, I have to listen again, he played on it.
He's on My Mind Plays Tricks on Me.
Yeah, he's playing the second rhythm guitar part on the right channel. You'll hear his guitar. I play the, it's not really a solo, it's more like of a rhythmic solo. And double track that.
And Ryan Allen is also on that cut.
Yeah, Ryan's doing the singing stuff. And he actually, that's the only stuff that was recorded not in the studio. He did his vocal parts at home. He was going to come to the studio, but he said, it'll be easier for me just to record it at home and send it to Jeff. And then Jeff, picks which takes he wanted to use. And but the basic album, we rehearsed the songs at our keyboard player's house, Kevin Darnell. And, you know, it was still, obviously, it was COVID, a year into COVID when we started making the record. But the room was so big that we were well more than 6 feet, probably 15 feet away from each other. Everybody wore masks except me when I was singing. And so we were taking our precautions, but it's kind of cool that Ron Vensko, our drummer, but Jeff Hupp's also a drummer, and Jeff's the bass player. So when those two lock in, Jeff's thinking like a drummer and a bass player at the same time. And I think it works really well. And we're not afraid to try different parts or different ideas, but Ron's he's a really solid drummer. He his tempo is really good. I mean, I've played with some great drummers, but as the song goes, if they're not playing to a click track, it can just kind of take off. But Ron's really good at ending the songs at the same, you know, tempo that we started it at, and which is good for live. And Kevin Darnell's great keyboard player. He's got a beautiful room. It's a really ambient room. So when we brought these songs down, it sounded big just when we were playing them right away. Yeah. And that was really cool. And also, I brought the songs down. I didn't tell anybody what to play, except if I had something really specific. But usually I trust these guys to make it sound, you know, like I'm here in my head. And if I don't, then we'll make some suggestions and some arrangement ideas they come up with. Also, I don't dictate to this band. This band's really good. And then when Joe came for the first rehearsal, I was kind of sold on him when we were playing. You know, I gave him, I think, 3 or 4 songs to learn. Right. One of the songs was called It's a Trap from the Beyond the Static album. And he puts a capo on. I play it, you know, it's in the key of A.
Yeah.
He put a capo on and he's playing it like it's in the key of G, but on the second fret. And I was like, how'd you know that the second guitar was capoed in that song? He said, I could hear it. It's like, okay, he's hired. He's hired. Because I don't think every guitarist would get that. Yeah, and then when he played parts that I recorded, it sounded like me playing, which, you know, but maybe even a little bit better. It's like, okay, this guy, he's kind of a perfect fit. So he was the fifth complicated man.
The fifth complicated man.
And yeah, we're all a little got our ways. And then, but we do have our complicated woman, Kristen Von B. She sang vocals with me in a couple of the tracks, and I think she did a fantastic job.
Right. So I was going to ask you about her because I thought I heard a female vocalist on a couple of the backing tracks, but I couldn't tell if she's on My Mind Plays Tricks on Me.
That's Ryan. But you know, Ryan, okay, he can sound like a female when he wants to, and especially in the key of the songs that I write, they're pretty high. Even when I do my own vocals, oh, is that a female background singer? I said, no, that's me. Or, oh, that's Ryan. But we finally, Kristen did vocals on I Want Everything and Keys to Your Heart. And she did a great job.
Yeah. Well, about My Mind Plays Tricks on Me, any particular trick your brain mass was up to that inspired the song?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about in the last interview that, you know, when the day after recording the Brian Wilson song for the Gem tribute album, I was having some issues. And that song, I wrote that song maybe right around that same time. And it was, I think it was just the COVID, the restaurant being closed and open again. And then we were forced to close again in December of 21. Yeah. You know, that's our busiest time of year. That's when you really can make the whole year. And it was really tough. And then when we finally opened again, it was, oh, okay, now I'm in front of all these people again. And it was the staffing issues and trying, you know, and my service staff, kitchen staff, they had to be around other people. They really couldn't be 6 feet apart from everybody. And
it was
really tough, you know, and there, you know, there are some people that weren't comfortable and left this, you know, the restaurant industry when COVID started, but we kept our core people. And it was just, maybe it was just the pressure, just always kind of being in that environment. You know, we, in the restaurant business, you couldn't work at home. Like my daughter, you know, worked for Chrysler at the time.
Yeah.
And she worked at home. And even my wife worked at home a lot. It's like, but here we're going, you know, we're going in the battlefield every day. And
right.
And then trying to make a record. And every time you're trying to make a record, you're asking yourself, is it as good as the last one? And any artist, I think, has those doubts. If they don't, then they're probably not really making good records in the first place. And My Mind Plays Tricks on Me. It was just kind of like, yeah, it was kind of precursor to what I was going through and what I was diagnosed with, some anxiety. And so I got that under control. And now I know that it was something real, not imagined. It's like, if I feel it coming on, it's like,
all right, take a couple deep breaths. Okay, it's all right. You know, you're not having a heart attack. So, and it, the fact that it took me this long to get there, that's okay. You know, I, if I need a little help, and that's fine.
You mentioned one of your daughters working for Chrysler at some point, and it's a different daughter that was doing some of your artwork. Is that correct?
Yeah, Marissa was my oldest. I have three daughters. Marissa, she took a new job. She works with another company in the similar type of position. She's a supply chain, and she's a buyer now for the company, but it's in the automotive. And then my daughter, Megan, lives in Madison, Wisconsin. She went to art school and she got an industrial design degree. And then our youngest daughter is Olivia. She just graduates from high school next year. She's on the spectrum of the ASD. So she's, after having, you know, two daughters that excelled in school and really, you know, had no difficulty, to have Olivia with her challenges, you know, it was different. It took a little bit to adjust to that, but she's like the happiest kid. She's very confident. She told me last week she was smarter than me. And I said, you really think you're smarter than your dad? Yes, Dad, I'm smarter than you. And then, you know, she's 4'8" and 99 pounds, 4'8". And just, she's beautiful and just the sweetest little person. And my wife and I would just sit. We always say we'd like to be inside her head just one day to see how she sees the world. And she's a real joy. And so her path is going to be different than our oldest daughter's. But she's fantastic. We recently moved. We bought a condo instead of owning a house that all the kids grew up in.
Yeah.
And she's got this big bedroom, and it's got big TV on the wall, and it's got her own private bath. And she's like, it's her own apartment. And she said, I never want to leave. I said, I never want you to leave either, but if you ever want to, you know, that's fine. But, you know, so we kind of got the right place for her as she's getting a little bit older and a little bit independent. She's got a little bit more privacy. And so, yeah, it's
earlier you had mentioned the artwork for, Heart Inside Your Head is kind of a takeoff of the Operation Kids game. Now, was that your daughter's idea? Whose idea was that to?
You know, I can't remember. I have a habit of taking credit for things I shouldn't, but I can't remember honestly, but originally she did do the artwork, and it looked like the original kind of Milton Bradley game. And Marty Scott, our record label owner, said, you know, we could have some, you know, copyright problems. Yeah. It's like, so then I think my daughter said, well, maybe we'll make it look like you, Dad. And so we did that.
Did you have a favorite, did you have a favorite kids game, favorite board game as a kid? Did you ever play Operation with your daughters even?
You know, we didn't play that with my daughters. You know, we did play when we were kids, but then we got into Monopoly. We were big Monopoly games. We played Trouble. Some of these games, you know, they're still around. They're still great, but we played Life. That was fun. I remember playing Life with our babysitter. That was pretty cool. I always had a babysitter because my mom worked, and babysitters were cool. They helped, they helped introduce us to music too, because I was 5 years old and we were listening to AM radio in Detroit, which was really good then. Keener 13 and CKLW, we kind of grew up on that. I remember my daughter or my babysitter explaining to me what the song Lola was about. I was like, oh wow. You know, I was like, that's pretty interesting.
How old were you then?
Talk about a song that's ahead of its time. I think, well, gosh, I don't know if I was maybe 10, I'm trying to think what year Lola came out. I'm thinking I was 10 years old.
So the record release show for the new album, Heart Inside Your Head, that was last Friday. Do you have any other gigs coming up?
You know, we are planning to go to Chicago September 10th. We'd like to go out East Coast, New Jersey, New York in the fall as well. Haven't set anything up yet. I'm going to talk to Marty about that, because he's got other bands in his labels that are New Jersey artists.
Right.
Weaklings, of course, Midnight Callers. Is that right? Midnight Callers? I get their name wrong. I know.
Yeah,
it's
that, I think that's right. They're, that is New York, right? And then what about the Gripweeds? They're in Jersey,
the
right?
Gripweeds, of course, too. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Kurt has a great studio, and so well, Anderson Council, not too far from them. So that would be great if we could do a gem show. But I'm going to put Marty in the spot and come up with that. So Marty,
yeah, there you go. There's got to be some good way to call that. You know, something the stars shining gem record star. You know, tying in stars and gems, something like that. Well, the track off the new album I want us to close out with is "Trying Too Hard," and I just want to point out, you know, your lyric work. The songs are great, but you know the lyrics are always really cool. I mean, just great wordplay. I guess the line I love and trying too hard is that I'm only playing for the win, you over, you know, the way it's like, it's a great little turn there.
Yeah, I have a habit of doing that. I'll do it. It could be a complete sentence, but then I'll continue it on to kind of twist the meaning. In fact, one of our old bass players in the Respectables brought that up to me. It's like, oh, do I do that? Yeah, I guess I do. It wasn't, you know, a conscious effort, but. Yeah, that's one of my favorite songs on the record. I mean, like they're all your kids. You can't pick a favorite, but that song, you know, it's just kind of a typical Nick song. It's a little bit more of a jangly kind of thing. And I've got my crunchy rock songs and I got my jangly songs. And so that's like in the jangly category. And I think Alan did some great harmonies on that. Someone said it kind of reminded him of Teenage Fan Club, which I love. And so it's always nice when someone adds a part away from the studio and then they send it to you. And then Jeff puts it in the mix and it's like, oh, that is so good. I can't imagine the song without that. You know, that's what Kristen and Ryan did to us. And Joe plays a guitar solo, one of our songs. It's like, God, it's such a great solo. I mean, I wouldn't have came up with that. So, you know, the band is, the band's great, you know, and Kevin comes up with some keyboard part, like when we did Hopes Up. He had this, it's a very E Street song to me. And it was just like, yeah, that's something Roy Bittan would have played. And it's like, oh, I said, can you play that again? And he said, what did I play? And then I remembered it so I could sing it to him. And it's like, okay. So these are all gifts from the band when they come up with these bits, as Paul McCartney. Paul and John always call them bits. And it's like, yeah, the little bits, you know. And
tasty bits.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Hey, thanks yet again for joining me for another Coolest Conversations.
Thanks, Manfred. We really appreciate it.
Well, let's give a listen now to this other track off your new album, Hard Inside Your Head. It's Trying Too Hard from Nick Puente and the Complicated Men in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Too Hard from Nick Puente and the Complicated Men. That one's off the new album Heart Inside Your Head, and it's available from Gem Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and a big thanks again to Nick for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time around, I'll be joined by Melanie Bamman. She was in both the Pandoras and the Muffs, and she's currently in the Coolies. And she counts as one of her bandmates, our very own Palmyra Del Ram. Their new single, King of Confusion, is out now on Wicked Cool Records, and we'll find out all about it next time on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
is a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.